I wonder what you got up to last Saturday. Anyone vote? Now, we know the results, don't we? It's in the last week, there's been hundreds of thousands of words written, things said about what happened last Saturday. So let's have a look. These, you might recognize the two guys at the top. And there's actually another guy there at the bottom, and I'll talk a little bit about something that he said. He's the treasurer in the New South Wales government, so he's making a comment on, among the many millions of comments that have been said, how did Liberal lose, why is there so many independents? I'm sure you've heard all that stuff all week. Now, whatever side of politics you support, okay, so people tend to support one or the other, or maybe none, whatever issues you feel are important, I think what this guy said had an impact. He was actually discerning something about what happened last Saturday. He's a Liberal Party guy. So he said this about the election loss for the Liberal Party. He said this: I don't blame any one individual. The party needs to rebuild after the devastating federal election loss by listening to the community on issues like climate integrity and women. So in his opinion, and I think that opinion's been shared by many people, the issue of listening, really listening to the community, was not a strong point of the last government, particularly towards the end. And the election loss was quite profound. So I want to talk about this issue of listening. I think it was one of the reasons the government didn't get another term. So I want to go to a story which is kind of a strange story in the Old Testament, but listening is at the heart of this story, and some profound things happen when somebody listens to somebody who wasn't previously heard. So 2 Samuel chapter 21. So this is during the reign of David. There was a famine for three successive years, so David sought the face of the Lord. The Lord said, it is on account of Saul and his blood-stained house. It is because he put the Gibeonites to death. So we're in the time of David. It's well into his kingship. And something happens. There's a famine. Now, if famine happens 1 year, you can handle that. Famine happens 2 years, you think that's bad luck. Famine happens 3 years, you're thinking something's going on here. Let's pay attention. So David recognizes this is not just a variation in the weather. Something is happening in the nation. And he gets a reply. He goes and seeks God, and it's on account of Saul and his blood-stained house because he put the Gibeonites to death. Something happened, and that's why the famine's happening. What's going on? Who were the Gibeonites? Back in the time of Joshua, Israel was going through the promised land. They're coming into the land of Canaan, and the Gibeonites hear about Israel defeating all these nations, and they're pretty scared. So they think, we're next on the list of nations to be defeated. We live in Canaan. How are we going to get out of this? So they have a plan to make a trick, to trick the Israelites so they won't kill them when they come. So they send a group of people along, a delegation, and they pretend that they've been traveling a long way. So they put moldy bread in their sack, and they put some yogurt in their skins instead of milk to make it seem like they've been on the road a long time. Pretty clever stuff. And so because they're not part of Canaan, they think, well, let's have a peace treaty. Israel will do a peace treaty with us. They won't destroy us like they're going to destroy all the other nations. The trick works. Israel makes a peace treaty with the Gibeonites, and so they don't harm them when they come into Canaan. These guys survive. This happened several hundred years before the time of David. And all that time, Israel had honored this agreement and had not attacked the Gibeonites. They'd let them live. So we read here that Saul had attacked and destroyed the Gibeonites. He tried to kill them all. So we're talking about the breaking of an ancient agreement. Saul broke an agreement with the Gibeonites. He went and tried to destroy them. Saul was zealous for God, and as often with Saul, he doesn't know the ways of God. His zeal for God even gets him in trouble. He got it wrong, as he most often did. He attacked and killed many of the Gibeonites. That's the history. So when David asks, why are we experiencing a famine for 3 years? God says, it's because this ancient agreement has been broken. That's why there's a famine. So in the Old Testament, understand the weather is not just the weather, it is connected with God, with the nation, with justice and righteousness. God, blessings and cursings, all of that stuff is connected. They're experiencing this famine, which is like a curse. There's a spiritual reason for it. It's not just bad luck. Something spiritual is happening. David realizes this, and so he says, God, what's wrong? He goes and seeks God, and he gets an answer. This ancient agreement has been broken. Now, David, despite all his failings, is wise. He knows the ways of God. He respects God, unlike Saul. So he's going to do something, and I think what he does next is extremely important. I think it's something we can learn from as individuals, in families, in business, and in politics. It reveals some underlying realities of how God relates to people and how he relates to nations. What does he do? Let's have a look and see what David does next. He goes and asks some people, eh? The king summoned the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now, the Gibeonites were not part of Israel, but were survivors of the Amorites. The Israelites had sworn to spare them, but Saul, in his zeal for Israel and Judah, had tried to annihilate them. David asked the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance?" So he summons the surviving ones and speaks with them. David asks them. What a radical strategy. He asks them, what would it take? How shall I make atonement so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance? Now, I think today, what would be our political strategy? Get the political parties together. They would get together. They'd hire some consultants, come up with a plan, roll it out, bring some brochures, and then that would say, we've fixed the problem. We've thrown some money at it, and it's fixed, isn't it? Does that sound like what would happen today? That's how it works, right? That's pretty close to how it would work today. I want to point out how different it is from David's approach in this instance. David asks the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance? The issue isn't even what God wants to happen. The issue is, what do they want to happen? How would you feel okay? What would it take for you to feel okay and bless Israel so that this curse can be put aside? This is a profound thing. God is not intervening to fix it for them. David is not even saying, God, what do you think about this? He's already got the answer. The next step is to ask the Gibeonites. It's only when they feel satisfied that the issue will be put to rest. Keep that in mind. It's not even what God thinks. It's what the Gibeonites think. That's what matters. Now, I don't know whether this looks like your household at all, anytime. Here's a couple having some disagreements. What happens after you have a disagreement? Now, let me speak from a bloke's perspective. You sit back and you think, oh, how did that happen? And you recognize it's not great, right? Eventually, you recognize something. You make plans to fix the situation. Right, okay, solve the problem. Flowers, chocolates. I'll do something around the house, put the plan into action. And most of the time it doesn't work. Is that close to the truth for some? Sometimes a bit like that, right? What haven't you done? You haven't listened. You haven't asked. What's actually the problem here? When a relationship goes sour, the most important thing is not to come up with a great strategy of how to fix it, your strategy. The most important thing is not even asking God. First and most important strategy, listen to the other person. That's the strategy. Let's read on. The Gibeonites answered him, "We have no right to demand silver or gold from Saul or his family, nor do we have the right to put anyone in Israel to death." Really saying, we've got no power here. We can't do anything about this. David, the one in authority, says this, "What do you want me to do for you?" They're not in a position of power, no right to demand anything. David gets that. What do you want me to do? The person in authority asks the other person, what can I do for you? He doesn't come up with a plan himself. He asks the Gibeonites, what should I do? It's not about how David feels about this. That's not the issue. It's not what he thinks about it. What's important is what they think about it and what they want to be done. And I think there's something in that response that helps us understand how to fix things, how to resolve issues, past wrongs. Someone, the person in authority, needs to ask. And then they need to listen. And then they need to act on what was said. These are very important points about how to resolve issues. For past wrongs, for people in positions of authority, the Gibeonites had almost been wiped out. They were understandably angry with Saul and hence with Israel. And when people are angry, often they want revenge. Let's see what happens. This is what they want. They answered the king, as for the man who destroyed us and plotted against us so that we have been decimated and have no place anywhere in Israel, let 7 of his male descendants be given to us to be killed and their bodies exposed before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the Lord's chosen one. Quite a request, right? And the king said, I'll give them to you. So this ask, 7 sons to be killed and left out for the animals to eat, a disgrace. This is serious revenge. Now, at this point, I want to say, you know, we read the Bible and people say, just obey the Bible. Some parts of the Bible don't obey. This is not written to be emulated or imitated in any way. That's what they wanted it for, to be resolved, and that's what they did, but it's not something we would do today. We're not meant to take revenge and kill the people we have problems with. That's not the way, even though it happens here. Obeying what's in the Bible doesn't mean doing everything in the Bible. It doesn't mean doing everything the Bible says. No, you learn from the Bible. Put into practice those parts which are relevant and express God's heart. But don't just do everything in there. You can get in big trouble for that. But David here, he does what the Gibeonites ask him to do. We would not do exactly what was asked. But the point is, he's listened and he's enacted their will. The revenge takes place. So verse 7, the king spared Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, because of the oath before the Lord between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. Revenge is taking place. David recognizes this is all about keeping covenant and agreement. I've got an agreement with Jonathan not to harm his son. So he spares Mephibosheth. Keeping these oaths is a good thing, certainly better than ignoring them as Saul does. David knows the ways of God. God is a keeper of oaths and covenants, and so David wants to be that. He's got authority as king to do that, to protect the oath that he's made to Jonathan. It's a good thing. But not everyone has the power to keep their oaths. Let's see what happens. Now, at this point, we're going to be introduced to someone else, Rizpah. She's on the wrong side of the equation. She married into Saul's family. That makes her descendants possible victims of the revenge. I don't think she had any part in killing the Gibeonites, but innocent people get caught up in things. Whenever violence occurs on the earth, there are almost inevitably innocent people who suffer. Justice for one can mean suffering for someone else. So the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the 2 sons of Aiah's daughter Rizpah, whom she had born to Saul, together with the 5 sons of Saul's daughter Merab, whom she had born to Adriel, son of Barzillai, the Maholathite. He handed them over to the Gibeonites, who killed them and exposed their bodies on a hill before the Lord. All 7 of them fell together. They were put to death during the first days of the harvest, just as the barley harvest was beginning. The bulk of the suffering in this situation falls on Rizpah and Merab and their families. They are the mothers of the 7 descendants of Saul who are killed to facilitate this revenge, to fix up this covenant problem. Their loss is great. In all likelihood, they're completely innocent of anything. They just married into the wrong family. Their sons are dead and disgraced. the Gibeonites are now feeling great. They've had their revenge. They're rejoicing. They got justice. But the price of that justice for the Gibeonites is devastation for Rizpah, Merib, and their family. Now something's going to happen in the story that's quite profound, and I think we have to get. The story's not over yet. This story comes as a block. Even though the Gibeonites are satisfied, we could finish the story here and say, David listened, the Gibeonites, he did what they said, and the Gibeonites were satisfied. That's kind of like a little story, but this story's bigger than that. There's other things taking place. If that was all the story was about, that would be great, but there's more. Verse 10, Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it out for herself on a rock. From the beginning of the harvest till the rain poured down from the heavens on the bodies, she did not let the birds touch them by day or the wild animals by night. She's the mother of two of the sons, the others are her nephews. Goes out on a rock, spreads out sackcloth, a sign of mourning. She's there from the beginning of the harvest till the rains come. The text tells us she's there for that long. Now in WA, harvest starts in November maybe, and the rains probably come in April. You've got that period of time. Israel is that opposite. About 6 months. Up to 6 months. Text is very clear to say she's there for 6 months protecting the bodies. Something's being said here. Her actions are not peripheral to the story. It's not just about David the king. It's not just about the Gibeonites. It's not just about authority structures or people being persecuted. As ancient wounds are healed, there is further suffering that happens. People like Rizpah are caught up in the midst of all this. In the big picture movements of history, it's the mothers, it's the grandmothers, it's usually women, sometimes it's men, but usually women. They bear the brunt of the failure of government, of economic policy, of social engineering. Her actions are quite incredible. They display a level of devotion and intensity far beyond all the other people in the story. This is where the heavy lifting of justice gets done. It gets done by these sort of people. It's easy to bypass her story. It's happening on the edge of things. She's on a rock out in the out in the wilderness. But the Bible doesn't bypass people like that. God sees people like this. God sees the suffering. He sees the devotion. He hears the cries of the innocent and the brokenhearted. These people are not invisible to God. The Gibeonites weren't thinking about these people when they sought revenge. David wasn't thinking about them. He got to keep his own personal covenant with Jonathan and saved Mephibosheth, which was right for him to do that. But people like Rizpah have no choice. They grieve and they mourn. They seek honor for those taken in war, in political struggle, in business negotiations, in colonization. All these things have happened throughout history. They continue to happen today. The news focuses on the big decisions of government, who's in control of this or that, who's pushing here or there. Underneath, there are people like Rizpah who keep their vigils, remember those who have fallen, and they're seen by God and never forgotten. They might be ignored by everyone else, but they're in the story. God knows they're there. Her actions are so profound, they actually prompt further actions by others. So the text goes on, verse 11. When David was told what Aiah's daughter Rizpah, Saul's concubine, had done, he went and took the bones of Saul and his brother Jonathan from the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead. They had stolen their bodies from the public square at Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hung them after they struck down Saul on Gilboa. So David hears about what she's done. He recognizes the godliness of what she's doing. And he's inspired, or maybe a better word is he's shamed into acting and putting something else right that should have been put right. More things need to be put right in the land. Verse 13, David brought the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan from there, and the bones of those who had been killed and exposed were gathered up. They buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the tomb of Saul's father Kish at Zelah in Benjamin, and did everything the king commanded. So the act of Rizpah prompts further acts of reconciling old wounds, of fixing things that had been sitting there in the memory of the people but not recognized. Saul and Jonathan's bones are given a proper burial. All those killed with them are given a proper burial. The families are getting closure after all these things that have happened. Shame is removed from the land. So there's like a domino effect of a series of unresolved issues being resolved, initiated by a famine that caused David to seek God and say why, and then said, went to the people and said, what can I do to help you with the memory of the devastation that's occurred? The Gibeonites didn't have the power to resolve their own situation. David sought God, got an answer, went and listened to the people who'd been offended by past wrongs. There was a king, there was a government who actually listened to what the people said. But even the process of putting things right results in further difficulty and struggle and suffering. Seven people are killed in the revenge. David keeps his oath because he's got the power to do it. Rizpah has no power. She only has the power of her devotion and her grief. She protects the bodies of her sons and her nephews. Her actions then inspire the closure of more wounds in the nation. The story began with the words, during the reign of David, there was a famine in the land for three successive years, and the story now ends. After that, God answered prayer in behalf of the land. The story is complete. It began, things are processed, and it now concludes where God answers prayer. It's a story about old agreements being broken, about people who are offended crying out for justice, about a person in authority who gains insight from God and listens to people. It's also a story about those who have been devastated by these experiences and the grief they hold. Finally, the land is healed after all of these issues are resolved. God answers prayer. Now, this is a profound story, I think. But I want to shift gears. I want to apply this story and its principles to something we live in today. Now, I'm not trying to be political. This is not left or right or anything like that. I want to take the principles in this story and say, how does that apply to our society today? Now, you'll recognize this. You might recognize this. This is a group of Indigenous Australians holding what's called the Uluru Statement of the Heart. It's a document that arose out of dialogues from around the country, inviting all peoples in Australia to join together in a journey of reconciliation. It invites the establishment of a voice to parliament for Indigenous people and a commission to do a truth-telling about what has really happened in this land. Now, whatever side of politics you ordinarily support, there's no doubt that Australia's Indigenous people have suffered greatly since colonisation. Great wrongs have been committed, including dispossession, numerous massacres, widespread suppression of culture, removal of children from family, and all sorts of acts of injustice. The land and God himself are witness to these events. In the story today, past wrongs were addressed and resolved, and it started with listening. Firstly, listening to God, then to the people who were wronged. After the listening, acting upon the requests that were made, putting things right, issue after issue resolves itself after the initial listening takes place. Ancient agreements are resolved. Things are put right. I think this is a model story for how to do reconciliation. I think that's how Australia can move forward. great wrongs have happened in our land with Indigenous people. God knows this. The government, whatever this is not political, whatever government it is, need to listen. Previous governments have promised to listen, but when it came time to hearing what was actually said, they said, we won't do that. Now, this Uluru Statement of the Heart is a serious attempt to try and find a way forward for us as a nation. It's been expressed. It remains for the government to respond. Now, it's interesting, Anthony Albanese, the first thing he said when he took the acceptance speech as Prime Minister, that he would take seriously, we would commit to this. Whatever your political persuasion, I think that's a sign of hope that some ancient wrongs can actually begin to be healed. Hopefully the women like Rizpah won't have to mourn much longer. A way forward can be found that brings hope to all people in Australia. Now, we don't normally take communion on the fifth Sunday, but it's Reconciliation Sunday. So we move to communion to today. I want to be clear. You know, Jesus invited his followers to remember him and what he'd done. The body, the bread, the blood, the cup. God became aware of our situation. We were lost in darkness. He heard the cry. He listened. He sent his son. He carried our sin on the cross and our sorrow. By his wounds we are made whole. You don't have to agree with what I've said about Indigenous issues to take communion. But we are invited to examine ourselves and to put things right, firstly with God, but also with one another, brothers and sisters. Reconciliation Sunday is a day to consider a wider circle of reconciliation, including the Indigenous people of our land. Jesus came for us all. He died for us all. He invites us all to be reconciled to God and also to all other people. And then to take whatever steps are needed for that reconciliation to occur. So as we take communion today, we have the four stations. I wonder, can the helpers come up? Take the bread and the cup. Eat the bread in your own time. Remember his body, the body of Jesus given for us. And we'll hold the cup and we'll drink it together as a sign that we are one in Christ and as a sign that we want to be one with all those who will trust and believe in him. I invite you to come.